This episode of Commentary, Trek Stars, is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
Hi, this is Robert Duncan McNeil, also known as Tom Paris from Star Trek Voyager. You're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Season 3, Episode 12 of Commentary, Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. Today we are beginning a new series on Robert Hewitt Wolfe, looking at his career as, I don't really know how to define it, a creative, not just a creator, not just a developer, but like the driving force behind a television show or project.
I know that it's hard to make this a clearly defined category for your bizarre OCD, but I would say as an unsung hero of many sci-fi shows.
Okay, that's what we'll call him, as an unsung hero. Today we're going to be looking at his work in Star Trek, and we're joined by Matt of the Delta Quadrant. How's it going, Matt?
It's going well. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. We really appreciate it. So, Matt, for those people who don't know, You are definitely a Star Trek fan. In fact, I was in attendance. I was in the room watching as you filled out a trivia contest while drunk and schooled everyone else at this Star Trek convention.
Oh, that's right. You were with me. Because, yeah, I don't remember. I remember Charlene was there, and I remember Lori was there, and I was kind of drunk and just focused on one thing.
Yeah, it was kind of amazing. It was like you were just like in the zone. You were like Michael Jordan when he was, you know, in the finals or something like that. It was insane, and no one stood a chance against you.
Somehow I felt smarter as I was drunk. Like I was doing things faster than I would have been sober.
You didn't have that self-doubt filter on.
I did, kind of, because I didn't want to do it at first, but they pushed me into it.
So yes, if you want to know anything about Star Trek, Matt is the guy to ask for sure. But you also do a podcast on Voyager.
I do. It's called the Delta Quadrant. It's through the TrekMate Network. I have been a co-host since episode three of season one. Yeah, there we go. So that has been going on for, I just had my 2-year podcasting anniversary back last November.
That's pretty cool.
And to date, we're in the middle of season 5.
So you've got about maybe a year and a half left?
If all goes according to plan, we should be done sometime in the spring, early summer of 2015.
So do you have any idea what you're going to do after you're done with the Delta Quadrant? Or
not a clue.
All right. Without the Delta Quadrant, there would be no Commentary Trek Stars, so go check it out for sure. It's over on TrekMate. But despite the fact that you do the Voyager show, you are at heart a Deep Space Nine fan, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
This is your favorite series of the 5 or 6?
It most certainly is.
Good for you. We agree. We approve. Well, let's take a look at Robert Hewitt Wolfe's career. Like we were just saying off mic, it's kind of hard to define because as a member of the writing staff of Deep Space Nine, it really feels like such a group effort that even though certain people are credited with certain episodes, it's not as clear-cut as that. There's a lot of overlap, and there's a lot of big ideas which were brought to the table by various people, and it's kind of hard to separate who did what on the show. But before we get into Deep Space Nine, Wolf got his start on The Next Generation with a script for Fistful of Data's.
Mm-hmm.
This was season 6, correct?
Pretty sure. Season 6, yeah, that's right.
And which means that he was like 27 years old when he wrote this thing, or 26, insanely young. But
it's kind of amazing, and I think Next Generation, you know, it's a show I really like, too, and what I appreciated about it is they took a lot of pitches from young writers. I mean, I think that Ronald D. Moore and Brannon Braga were both very young when they joined that writing staff as well. So
yeah, for sure. Well, Fistful of Data's, for those people who don't remember, is the holodeck episode with Worf, where he's in the Old West and there's a bunch of Data's running around.
You forgot about Alexander, the star of the episode.
Oh yeah, Alexander's in it too.
It's a good episode. People forget that it's actually good because they remember just how silly it was.
Mm-hmm. Oh, people rate this as some. I've seen this pop up on some of the worst of TNG lists, and I think to myself, I can think of 10 other episodes that are far worse than this. I actually love this episode.
Yeah, it's one of those things. It's one of those weird things where you judge the original series silliness with very little rancor, but the silliness on Next Gen is vilified as though it's like it maybe ruined the show periodically, which is crazy because the silliest episodes were still pretty close to the other episodes in terms of overall dramatic function.
Yeah, and I think what TNG and DS9 also proved is that it's okay to have fun once in a while.
Yeah, and there's nothing... That's the thing that's weird about it. I mean, this is one of the least silly of the silly episodes. There's an episode where a bunch of characters turn into kids for no good reason. you cannot say that A Fistful of Data's is bad because it's silly, and then somehow not want to kill people because of Rascals.
See, right. I love Rascals.
I don't mind it too much either. In fact, I would say that TNG Season 6 is probably my favorite season of that show.
Yeah, I would agree with that, for sure. By far. But Fistful of Data's, I think, is a perfectly good episode, too. It would never be at the top of the list for me, but it's nowhere close to the bottom, either. I definitely think it's a solid episode of television.
It would be... I don't know exactly where this would show up in, an overall hierarchy of episodes, but, it's not... If there was a bottom 20, it wouldn't be in that. If there was a top 20, it might very well be in that.
Yeah, I wouldn't go that far, but it's definitely upper middle, for sure.
Okay.
Apparently it was good enough, because Worf was invited back a couple years later.
Not even.
No, I guess it would be.
TNG Season 6 is the season that DS9 premieres, so right. When he pitches Fistful of Data's, they were just getting ready to go on with DS9, so I'm sure once they saw this script, they're like, hey, we could use this guy on the new show.
Right, so he would have been 28 then, probably around this time. Okay, 27, 28. So they invite him in to rewrite Q-less, which is the episode of Deep Space Nine, which features Vash and Q very early on in season one. And according to Terry Erdman's book on the making of Deep Space Nine, the Deep Space Nine Companion, which is one of the best books ever written about a television show, after the first draft of Q-less, the producers were so impressed by Worf's work that they offered him a job on the writing staff, which he accepted, and quickly started writing episodes in season one, including the finale of season one, In the Hands of the Prophets. So right there, that's a pretty big deal. Anytime you're writing the finale of a television show, and a show which at this point didn't have a whole lot of continuity, and this was one of maybe four or five episodes in that first season which were very continuity heavy in terms of the mythology, and they give it to him.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you guys think about in the Hands of the Prophets?
Well, Mike, you and I, a long time ago, were on the Best of DS9 Seasons for Colin's show.
Ah, yes.
And In the Hands of the Prophets was actually one of the episodes I chose as one of my favorites from season one.
Yeah, I'm sure I did too.
And I think it's brilliant. I mean, Robert Hewitt Worf, as they got later into season one, was instrumental in breaking away from DS9 season one's TNG mold. I feel like early DS9 season one is much more concerned with bringing over the TNG audience. So that's why it's so broken up and episodic, where it won't later be. But toward the end of season one, you start planting the seeds of what the show eventually will become, and it culminates in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where you get, of course, Louise Fletcher as Vedic Wynn for the first time, who is both masterfully written and acted from episode one.
Definitely. The other episode from season one, which Wolf is credited with writing, is The Passenger.
Ray Oventica.
Yeah, that was the one, right, where the guy implants his personality on
Bashir.
A precursor to Batman Beyond Return of the Joker.
Dude, people implant their personalities on members of Star Trek crews a lot.
But using, like, dude, microchips and stuff?
Well, not exactly using microchips, but lest we forget the finale of TOS, where a woman switches bodies with Kirk.
Oh, I thought we were forgetting that. I thought that was the new rule.
So moving on to season two, the first episode that he co-wrote was Invasive Procedures, and then he also did Second Sight, Shadow Play, and then The Wire, which a lot of people think is one of the best episodes of the series.
He created Omar.
So Matt, what are your thoughts on The Wire?
It's like you said, I think it is one of the best episodes, maybe if not of the whole series, but definitely of season two. That's where, I mean, Garrick becomes much more nuanced, because up to that point we had seen him in the second episode of season one, and I believe in the episode Cardassians in season two. And in his second appearance, he gets a little bit more nuanced, but here you start delving into the man's past. And this is where you meet Inabrantane for the first time. And his story becomes one of such, you know, intrigue and mystery that makes him one of the best recurring characters in all of Star Trek, if not all of science fiction.
I think that's definitely true. Max, any thoughts on The Wire?
I have a weird feeling about Garrick, because when the show was originally on, I didn't really care for any episode that was centered around Garrick.
Really?
And then towards the end of the series, like, he became very, you know, like a very important character in the overall arc of the show, and now when I watch it, I don't find Garrick episodes as tedious as I did originally, because I know where they're going. But like, he's just mysterious without any real answers or significance. He's like a spy, but, like, just that's what he is. He's a spy, sort of, kind of, maybe. And, like, there's so little actual information about what he is. I don't even know if I'm supposed to hate this guy early on, because I don't know. I still don't know where his loyalties lie in season one.
See, but for me, that was the interesting part about him, is that because the mystery was so palliative and so intense, that I liked not knowing where this guy was going to go.
Yeah, for me, it was just I got the impression that nobody knew where it was. I got the impression that the writers didn't know where his loyalties lied, and that basically they were just coming up with it as it went along.
Yeah, they probably were, but
I can't get interested in a character who maybe at some point will be given a motive. That makes sense.
I mean, to me, like, I guess what you're saying, Max, is how he started off, and really, like, through the first season, that's really how I felt about him. And, you know, starting with things like The Wire, you start, you know, peeling back the layers on that character and understanding what's going on with him. And I think there was a definite shift somewhere in the middle of the series, pretty much unannounced, where they were just like, oh, you know, this character has gone from, well, you don't know, maybe he is this, maybe he isn't this, we don't know, to just like, yes, he is that, you know that he is that, we know that he is that, we might not say it flat out. To me, as the series progressed, it became clear that, you know, he was not plain and simple Garrick, you know what I mean?
We get told that pretty flat out with that two-parter in season three,
right?
Improbable Cause and the Dias cast,
and that's probably the point. You know,
season three is where it starts to change. But early on, I found Garrick episodes tedious because I still don't think that they really knew what they were doing with him.
But The Wire, am I mistaken in that The Wire would be the first episode where he actually plays a role, which is something beyond just, you know, mysterious guy in the corner?
Well, he kind of had a more expanded role in Cardassians, that second episode that he was in, but not terribly significant. This is the first time where he's the A story.
Right, yeah. Yeah, with that one, it was more he was brought in because of this other character, but this is where it's definitely him.
This is also the one where they finally sort of admit, yeah, he's a spy.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to say what kind of spy, but yes, you know it, we know it.
I believe this is also the episode where we first hear the words Obsidian Order for the first time.
No, that could be. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the final episode that he wrote in season two was The Collaborator, which he co-wrote with Ira Stephen Baer. Now, what do you guys think about that one? That there's a lot of, I won't say debate, but a lot of interesting discussion about that episode.
I'm kind of middle of the road to positive on this one. Now, it's been a long time since I've seen it. But I think what he, you know, just judging from he was a writer of both In the Hands of the Prophets and The Collaborator, he does a pretty good job of establishing the character of Wynn. And if the episode gets nothing else right, her characterization is pretty much solidified by this episode. I mean, it was solidified in the first one, but this one, she actually gets to be Kai. Mm-hmm. And she's going to be, obviously, I don't know if they knew ahead of time, but they're planning her in a position where she's going to be a constant problem now, because she has the power to be.
A lot of the episodes of Deep Space Nine play so close to like actual historical precedent that... And sometimes I do find it frustrating that no one is like bringing up how similar things are to things that happened in Earth history. And this is definitely one of those episodes.
So if you look at Second Sight and The Collaborator, both of those were written by Baer. Whether or not that was by design, I don't know. But you could tell that they hit on something, because in between seasons, it was Baer and Wolf who came up with the idea for The Defiant and pitched it to Berman and whatnot.
Yeah. Originally the called The Valiant, but they dropped it because they didn't want another V ship, because Voyager was about to premiere. So it took on the much, I think, cooler name of The Defiant.
Yeah. But they still got in that joke in season six or seven.
You're a terrible person.
I love that joke. Anyway, well, what do you guys think about The Defiant? At the time, it was obviously seen by some as a cop-out, and it was seen by others as a blasphemy, you know, a warship in the Star Trek universe. And to some people, it was just seen as something which was rather badass. Matt, where do you fall on The Defiant? Well, first off, were you watching Deep Space Nine at this point in time, or not?
No, and see, this is the I guess you would call frustrating thing. I was just about to get into Star Trek around this time, because The Defiant is introduced in like the fall of 1994, I think, is when the third season premieres. I do not jump on board the Star Trek bandwagon until my dad takes me to see Generations when it's in the theaters later in 1994.
Okay.
And then I start watching The Next Generation reruns.
Mm-hmm.
I never got to DS9 until 2003 when the DVD sets came out?
It would have been right around that time, because I remember watching them with my cat, and right. I got him in 2003.
That's when I started getting into it, because I tried to watch DS9, but when it was originally on, because it was syndicated, it was on really late, so it was like past my bedtime when I was a kid. And second of all, I mean, by the time I started jumping on, it was well into season four or end of season three. So, like, I was lost. Yeah. And, you know, when you're that young, you're not ready to comprehend a serialized story. I mean, I was all of, you know, 7 years old. So it took me until I was 14 to actually start watching it. But if you're asking me where I fell on The Defiant when I got to it, I fell into the rather badass category, because they had established the need for weaponry with the season two finale with the Jem'Hadar. DS9 kind of helped me realize that I was never that in love with the Gene Roddenberry concept of utopia to begin with. I mean, it's a fun thought, but it doesn't make itself presentable for the essence of drama, which is conflict. So I appreciated when DS9 broke away from those rules and traditions of some of the previous Star Treks, and The Defiant was the representation of that. And when it came in, it was just the coolest little ship that ever existed. And, you know, I think when The Defiant comes in is when people say, now, looking back on it, say, DS9 has arrived. And, you know, it becomes such a integral part to the series from then forward. So they had a good impulse there. And it made them mobile, which was a complaint of a lot of viewers.
During this period, I talked with a lot of people about a lot of things, and Star Trek was a regular topic of conversation. And when Deep Space Nine was in this period, and The Divide was introduced, it was a topic of conversation. And around the table, various people had various opinions. And I recall one friend of mine thought, good, finally, get off that station, do some stuff. And I thought, Yes. And another friend said, it's kind of stupid that they're bringing out a ship. I mean, weren't they doing like the exact opposite? They were like, we're not going to be doing that. And now they're like, just saying, ah, screw it, we got to do that. And I was like, interesting. And my feeling was, I don't think that I am on board with any of these hypotheses. I don't think that it's that simple. And ultimately, I think that that we don't know if this will work until we see how they use it. And I take issue with the idea that it was in some way, like, in defiance, no pun intended, of the Roddenberry rules and ideals, because it really isn't. Like, on the surface, if you don't look at it with any depth, I mean, it's very easy to say, like, oh, it's a warship. That's a betrayal of Roddenberry's ideals. But it's really not. It's just one of those weird edge cases where you go, I guess even in a utopia, you would need a ship capable of doing some pretty awesome damage if you were dealing with the Borg.
Yeah.
So, well, like, all of that kind of, you have to look at it on this, on the case itself, on what it actually is. And what it actually is was really just another element in the show's overall, like, toolkit. Like, having a station, like, yeah, they still have the station, and having the Defiant basically just means that they can defend the station better. And that's really all they really do with it for, like, a couple years, until, like, the war really gets started. And, like, the war is a whole different argument, and that I had that conversation with very different and much angrier friends. But, like the Defiant was not a big deal for me. I was basically just waiting for how they would use it.
Okay. Yeah, for me, like, at this point in time, I was young when I was watching it. I was 14 years old as well, and you know, I remember going to conventions and overhearing people when Deep Space Nine first started, and I remember hearing, you know, vendors and fans talking and saying, like, this show's never going to work because they're not leaving the station. This is ridiculous. And I always thought that was a weird thing, and I liked the fact that Deep Space Nine was different and that people were coming to them and that they had, like, sort of a safe haven for which these characters to grow. But I was impressed with Deep Space Nine right out of the gate. I was also, at that age, willing to accept anything that Star Trek wanted to give me. But I do remember, you know, with Season 7 of Next Generation airing, and everyone, you know, going all crazy over the fact that it was ending, and it got that nomination for the Emmy for Best Drama. Hmm. And I remember thinking, that's weird, because clearly the current season of Deep Space Nine, Season 2, is better than Season 7 of Next Gen.
That's not true, but that's fine.
It is true. But
no, it's not, but whatever.
But it was at that point that I was so in love with Deep Space Nine that when they said the Defiant was happening, first off, as a kid, it's like, oh, a ship which is designed to blow things up? Yes, please, now. But also, I was like, I'll watch whatever they're going to show me. I totally trust these guys because they're making some awesome television right now. You know, my life was built around Deep Space Nine at that point in time.
And at this point, you had been a Star Trek fan for about 6 or 7 months?
No, at that point, it was like 2 years.
Okay.
Yeah. I saw my first episode of Star Trek 9 days before Deep Space Nine premiered.
That's ridiculous.
It's weird, isn't it?
No.
Just coincidence. But
it's not weird, it's just bad.
Okay. So I was all for the Defiant. And that then once it came out, what did you guys think? You know, Matt, how do you feel that the Defiant was used by the show?
Well, I feel like I'm kind of commenting on my feelings like after the fact, because I saw it way after the show was over. So yeah. I could see exactly where it was going. If, you know, immediately if I wanted to. I never had to wait for it.
Yeah.
But I loved what they did with it. What I think DS9 did best, and one of my favorite things for DS9, was that it took the seeds that were planted in the Next Generation of this 24th century universe, and it looked deeper into them. And we found out more about the species that we were introduced to in Next Gen. And the Defiant was another tool that helped do that. Now, you know, like Max said, it wasn't really used for much beyond certain missions until the war. But I think by being mobile, it just made the show more expansive. And it just opened the door for new and creative ideas. And it was a badass ship, and still at 14 years old, I loved it.
Max?
Honestly, I don't think it's even worth talking about. Like, it's just a thing that they did on the show. Like, the idea that they introduced a ship on Deep Space Nine, why is that a topic of debate? Like, it's a thing that happened on Star Trek, and it didn't really change the show in any significant way. So the only reason, like, it's a thing that people talk about is because at the time, people were like, heavens no! Oh, those fools of Deep Space Nine. Know they not what they do there? Have they not read Star Trek books? It's ridiculous. I mean, like, they made a good show, and there was a spaceship at some point, and it fit totally into the storyline. It doesn't even feel forced when it's introduced. It feels like, yeah, that makes sense. They would get a ship.
I can see what you say, but I guess... My thinking is, like, it was a big deal. You know, it was a big...
It was a silly thing to be a big deal.
Well, maybe that's what it was. but I mean, if you look at the way that Star Trek has always operated and the way it's been structured, like, I can imagine Bear and Wolf sitting around, you know, one of their offices discussing this and coming up with this idea and then just building it up in their heads and then thinking, like, there's no way that they're going to let us do this, you know, and then pitching it to, say, Berman or whoever, and you know, thinking probably that they're going to get rejected. I mean, I can definitely see the risk there.
The thing is that I think that when we make a big deal out of this thing that they did that was so bold, we're ignoring that, like, really it's not. Really, it's not a huge thing that they did. Like if I told you that there was a science fiction show that was set in a space station, and, like, for a long time they did all of their traveling in these, like, little tiny ships that could, like, maybe hold, like, five people at, like, maximum, and then they got a much bigger ship in, like, season three. Like, would you think that was a weird thing?
Well, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is for a science fiction show, yes, no, whatever. But for the show, which was supposed to be the space station show.
Yeah, and like presenting a spaceship that can carry a bunch of people, that doesn't change the show.
I don't have any problem with it. I think it's perfectly fine, but I can definitely see how it was a big deal.
My problem is that it actually isn't a big deal. And when we make a big deal out of it because people thought it was a big deal, then we're essentially playing into the idea that because some people think it's a big deal, we need to all have a debate about this thing that was really just a good plot point.
Well, then good. Let's have a debate about it, because at that point, Next Gen is off the air. Voyager's not ready. Even if it wasn't a big deal, which I think is questionable, it got people's attention, and people are talking about the show and are curious about the show, whether they're negative on the idea of the Defiant or for the idea of the Defiant. They're talking about the show, which is the ultimate goal. You want people talking about your show.
I think, and I think that there's sort of a negative side to it too, because a lot of the debate about Deep Space Nine essentially comes down to why it wasn't popular, why it wasn't successful. And people say because they were on a space station, because it was more serialized, because it was almost entirely driven by the character stories, because of all of those things that made it good, that's why we really can't do it again.
Yeah.
And that is precisely the thing that we should not be playing into.
Well,
like, that's why we got Voyager and then Enterprise, and why we'll never get a show set in Star Trek on a space station ever again.
Well, you could be right. All right, well, let's move on to Season 3. And if we take a look at Season 3, this is when he definitely teamed up with Ira Steven Behr almost full-time. And you look at the stuff that they did together, either having written the episodes themselves or having written the screenplays or just the stories. He was involved with The Search, which was the premiere, Second Skin, Past Tense, which was another two-parter, which was a really big deal, Heart of Stone, which was the episode which played in every single city that I went to on my road trip with my family that summer on vacation.
It was stalking you.
Yep. Profit Motive, Distant Voices, Through the Looking Glass, Family Business, and then the finale, The Adversary. I mean, those are all the really big episodes. And of course, you know, a lot of that has to do with the fact that his writing partner is the showrunner. But mm-hmm. maybe that's something that we should talk about is, you know, Ira Stephen Baer, as the showrunner, presumably can write with whoever the hell he wants to. And he picked Wolf because, for whatever reason, the two of them had chemistry. And, you know, when we were in Vegas at the convention, you know, I saw Ira Stephen Baer talk, and someone brought up, I think, Ron Moore or something like that. Mm-hmm. And Baer was very quick to point out that even though other people on the staff get a lot of credit because basically they were there the whole time, a lot of the credit for the series' success really needs to go to Robert Hewitt Wolf. And a lot of the ideas, like The Defiant and some of the development with the Dominion and what have you, yeah. came from Wolf.
And he was there before Moore. Moore doesn't come into the series until Next Gen ends, so he doesn't come in until season 3.
Right, so he was actually there the same amount of time as all those guys who finished the show. He was just there on the front end instead of the back end.
Right, and that quote is actually why I wanted to do Robert Hewitt Wolf for this.
Yeah.
Because he was, like, I knew he was a significant player, but, like, I thought of him as, like, a bishop. You yeah. know, I thought, like, he's a bishop. Ron Moore was probably, like, a knight or maybe a rook. And Ira Stephen Baer was either the king or the queen. It doesn't matter. Whichever beard color he had at the time would determine that. And like, I didn't really think a lot about it. But, like, when I heard that, I was like, is Robert Hewitt... Is he one of them? Is he the queen? Is he the king? Which one is he? Because, like, he obviously had to be one of them for a while. And that changed my perception of how Deep Space Nine developed.
If you're not going to count Pillars... See, we're getting away from our Beatles analogy, which was very solid. But if you want to
have all of the guys, you have to expand it out of the Beatles.
Okay.
No, it needs to become more like an Earth, Wind, and Fire thing where there's like 17 members.
Well, let's just say this though. Okay, we said this in our Ron Moore thing. We were trying to figure out who was the Beatles, and we were saying, you know, if Ira Stephen Baer is
if John is the Kirk, is the Ira Stephen Baer?
Jeez.
And Ringo is the Chekhov.
Don't make this any more complicated than it is.
I want to make it as complicated as possible. I want to make this a game of 3D showrunner chess analogy metaphors.
You're going to send Mike in the OCD panic.
But let's just go back here. When we did our Ron Moore series, we were trying to figure out who was who as far as a Beatles analogy is concerned. And we said Ira Stephen Baer was John.
No.
And Ron Moore
I never
was
said
Paul.
That.
Maybe you didn't, but I don't think
that you can figure out where Ira Stephen Baer fits in that metaphor. My point was that Ira Stephen Baer and our understanding of Deep Space Nine do not fit the Beatles metaphor.
Maybe, but that's not what we were saying back then, for sure, regardless.
I said he might be the George.
So I asked Robert Hewitt Wolf on Twitter
mm-hmm.
who was who, which Beatle was which, mm-hmm. and he said, you know, Pillar is John, Ira is Paul. Too many people to figure out the other ones. However, I think if you were to ask Ira Stephen Baer, he would say that if he were John, his Paul was Robert Hewitt Wolf.
Okay. But if you asked John, which Deep Space Nine showrunner and creative person was the him of the show, he would say, I've been dead for several decades.
Yes. Yeah, I was going to say, you get to ask him via Ouija board.
Regardless of all this.
We asked the prophets point, what John would think.
Yes. The point,
they would know.
The point of all this is that while not as high profile as Michael Piller or Ira Stephen Baer or Ron Moore, or maybe even not as high profile as Rene Echevarria, I think that Robert Hewitt Wolf and... you know, Ira Stephen Baer, and I think everyone else here would agree, had a much larger role in the creation of this series than most people give him credit for.
Yeah, and that's why I want to do this, because I don't, like, until I heard that, I didn't think about him as being that significant. a player in Deep Space Nine and Star Trek history. But apparently, I have to like add in his involvement, and it, maybe it'll help some pieces make sense because there are still some outliers that that I can't contextualize from Deep Space Nine.
Yeah. Okay, so just moving on to his last couple years, not that there's much more to add to this, but just to give him credit where credit is due. Season 4, he did The Way of the Warrior, Little Green Men, Homefront and Paradise Lost, Bar Association, Hard Time, To the Death, Broken Link, Apocalypse Rising. He was one of the writers of the story of Trials and Tribulations, which I guess everyone was. Let He Who Is Without Sin, The Ascent, In Purgatory Shadow by Inferno's Light, Ties of Blood and Water.
Oh, we get it. He wrote the season.
Blaze of Glory and Call to Arms. That's seasons 4 and 5. So he ended with the finale. And after writing all of those episodes, he decided that it was time to move on. In the Erdman book, Bear says that he knew that he was going to be leaving. He could just sense it. And it sounds like he was basically burned out. And according to Wolf, he didn't really feel like he could do justice to those characters anymore. He thought that he had done everything that he could do with them, and that it was time to move on to other things.
Yeah, you hear about it from time to time. I mean, that happens on like any long-running show. People who've been around since the beginning leave at some point, despite having done a whole bunch of amazing stuff, and people ask them, why did you leave? And they always say, I couldn't think of anything else.
Yeah,
I was tapped out.
Right, which is understandable. I can totally see that.
A bunch of people left the X-Files in like season 5, and like at the time I was like, why are these guys going? And apparently it was like we ran out of urban legends. We couldn't think of anything else.
Yeah, yeah.
When we did the third vampire episode, we were like, we're out. We're done.
Yep. He did come back to write one episode freelance in season 7, which was Field of Fire, which I don't even know what that episode
which
is
one of the few which is one of the few Esri episodes I like. It's the one where she has to find the killer and uses Jiran.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I like that episode. That's good. Yeah.
Every episode is fantastic. She's the best character on Deep Space Nine.
Max named his cat Esri. If that tells you anything.
It tells you a lot if you know me.
Yes. All right. Well, Matt, any final thoughts on Robert Hewitt Wolf and his work in Star Trek?
Well, you know, having watched the box sets, I watched a lot of the behind-the-scenes features, and he figures prominently into a lot of them. And when he talks, I can see the passion that he had for what he was doing and how proud of the work that he did. You know what I mean. He was proud of his own work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's very much deserved. I mean, going through that list that you just rattled off, I mean, I only found one episode that I didn't really care for. The rest I loved.
Mm-hmm.
And he was instrumental in making the show what it was. And I'm glad you guys are doing the show because you're right, he's an unsung hero. The misconception, and I held this for a long time, is that, you know, Ronald D. Moore was the one who made the show what it was. And he did play an instrumental part. I'm not trying to downplay Ronald D. Moore. But, you know, because I think later, because of what he does with Battlestar, a lot of the darker elements of DS9 are attributed to him. Mm-hmm. Because they're his style. But no, Wolf was there from the beginning and doing it before Moore was. Moore jumped on and helped. But it really, a lot of it originates from Wolf. And I think that, you know, credit's due where it's due. And so I will always be grateful to him. DS9, like you said, is my favorite series. So, and he played an instrumental part in that.
Yeah. Max, any final thoughts?
Well, I mean, I think this the context that we have here doesn't really facilitate the ability to have final thoughts. My thoughts are essentially, this is going to be interesting. Because I am very excited to start tracing lines to connect things. Because, some elements that are in Deep Space Nine that I've never been able to quite fit together with other elements, I think it might actually start to fit together once I understand Robert Hewitt Wolf's involvement, who I like to call R.H. Dubs. But I'm excited about figuring out what his deal is. And I think I've got like a little preview because I have actually watched a whole bunch of Andromeda. I watched a whole bunch of it for our Roddenberry thing. Because I actually enjoyed watching it. But I'm excited to have final thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I think what you're saying is really interesting. Yes, he did play an integral role in Deep Space Nine, and it is kind of amazing. You know, he's one of those guys. I mean, with all of those guys on Deep Space Nine, even people like Ron Moore, it's hard to separate and say, like, well, yeah, you gotta love that guy. He wrote that episode, which is totally something you can do on Next Gen or the original series.
Mm-hmm.
But here, it's just like...
You can tell a Minoski episode...
Right, from a mile
like,
away.
Well, from like a thumbnail, like several rooms away.
Right. But
out of focus.
But with DS9, it's completely different. You know, it was really a team. You know, it's not like basketball, where you have one superstar who's just dominating the court and the other four guys just need to be passable. It's like baseball, where you have, you know, a pitching rotation and five guys and they all need to be on their game. Otherwise, you know, one superstar is not going to do the trick. So he was definitely, I would say, a solid number two pitcher. And baseball analogies are fine because we're talking about Deep Space Nine. You know, if Bear was the ace of the staff, Robert Hewitt Wolf, R.H. Dubs was a solid number two.
Wait,
so,
if he was the ace?
Yes, that's what they call it. Never mind, I'll explain it later.
So there's a card metaphor in baseball?
It could be, yeah, I guess. Yeah.
So who's the Joker?
The Bat Boy. Who cares? You know, let's just move on. Enough with the metaphors.
I like it when we get lost in metaphors.
Okay, all right, fair enough. But like you're saying, I am really curious to see because, you know, he left the show to go do other things. And now we're going to get to see what those other things were.
Yeah.
And I'm excited because I'm really not that familiar with any of them. So it will be an exciting journey. So Matt.
Yes.
Where can people find you on the internet?
You can reach me through my Twitter handle. It's at mhansen0207, and Hansen is Hansen. And you can also reach me at the Delta Quadrant. Our handle for that is at Delta Quadrant Cast, QUADT_cast.
And where can people find the podcast?
The podcast is part of the TrekMate Network, so it's trekmate.org.uk, and we release new episodes every Thursday.
Sweet. All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us. We really appreciate it. And
yeah.
Thank you
for having me.
Oh, no problem. And we'd love to have you back on the show anytime.
I'd love to come back.
Well, that was fun talking to Matt about Robert Hewitt Wolf.
Yes, it was.
That guy knows a whole lot about Star Trek. It's kind of intimidating, actually.
Yes. He knows more about Star Trek than Memory Alpha.
Yes. But that's not the only thing we're talking about on Trek FM over here. We've got a bunch of shows for you. We've got new shows, got the Melodic Treks going, we've got special things with the Matter Stream, talking to like Richard Hatch and stuff like that. So here's a taste of what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Pitching a piece of the action movie.
I think we can definitely say that the
they might go
that
for
the
that,
Transformers
though.
Planet doesn't work. They might go for that. Would you go for that, Drew?
I mean, personally, I would shy away from it because then you'd be...
Or would you shy away
it
from
be,
it?
You're a bad person.
Earl Grey.
William T. Riker.
Imagine now if he'd come back with a goatee or mutton chops. We could have been a very different Riker.
Hipster Riker. Number one, are you wearing glasses?
No, it's Geordi's visor.
I'm reading a pad that you've never heard of before.
The Ready Room.
Inside a Lost Time with Mark Cushman.
But something else that you'll find out in book two is that they almost didn't have Leonard Nimoy and Mr. Spock for season two of Star Trek. His agent wanted more money for Leonard, and for good reason, because when he signed on to do the series, he was supposed to be a supporting actor, and yet he was getting more fan mail than even William Shatner, who was the star of the show, yet only a fraction of the money.
The Orb.
Move Along Home as a TOS episode.
Sisko comparing First Contact to dating girls felt like something that Kirk would do as well, you know, teaching Charlie Evans about girls in Charlie X, something like that.
To the journey!
Voyager on Blu-ray.
I know that there's been some outtakes done because you can find clips of them on YouTube, but there's gotta be more. And I wanna see them all.
Warp 5.
Andorians on Enterprise.
And so they took this idea where they had antenna, and they took this idea where they were blue and from someplace cold, or I don't even know if they were someplace cold when they were on the TOS, and they just made everything better.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Iris Stephen Bear recap.
I think when you look at the work that was done on Deep Space Nine, what becomes apparent is a group of people who do not feel like they need to do what the original series did in order to accomplish what the original series accomplished.
Melodic Treks.
Apparently, at one point, Patrick Stewart felt he might be able to actually play on screen himself, although it was delicately pointed out to him by Bryce Martin that he wasn't up to that standard quite yet.
Literary Treks.
Peaceable Kingdoms with Peyton Ward.
I don't really remember why I was the one chosen to bat cleanup, other than the fact that I think Margaret, our editor, wanted Picard and the Enterprise E to factor into the final installment, and she had already tapped me to write that story.
Matter Stream.
Star Trek Axanar with Alec Peters and Richard Hatch.
If you've ever experienced war or any kind of conflict where everything is life and death, there's a certain kind of resolve, truth, experience that you come to that I don't think too many people can understand or ever really, really empathize with.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows to get in on the daily Trek Talk. We have new shows for you every day, and you'll find them on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune. Or you can stream and download files from the website. Just visit trek.fm/pd for podcast directory to get all the links. So, you know, Robert Hewitt Wolf, he's written a book.
I think he's written more than one.
He might have. He might have written two. Was he a co-writer on the Rules of Acquisition?
I feel like it.
Yeah. My wife carries that book around with her in her purse. She's also
really
got
not a good sign.
She's also got a copy on her Kindle, just in case she ever needs it. Regardless.
Don't make any business dealings with her.
He also wrote Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Legends of the Ferengi, along with Iris Stephen Bear. Now, you can get this book for free on audible.com because you're a Trek FM listener. I've actually never read this book myself, but it sounds really interesting if you look at the summary here. Once you have their money, never give it back. Anything worth doing is worth doing for money. For centuries, these and other famous Ferengi rules of acquisition have been the guiding principles of the galaxy's most successful entrepreneurs. But the wisdom behind them was not won without a high cost in lives and latinum. Now at last, these inspiring tales of avaricious Ferengi wresting monetary gain from the jaws of poverty are available to the profit-hungry across the galaxy. I'm sold.
Yes, that sounds very funny.
Ferengi-like, right?
Well, funny. It sounds funny.
Yeah. This thing's narrated by Armin Shimerman. I mean, what more could you ask for?
Reading a funny book, not having to see him in Ferengi makeup. I don't think there's anything else you could ask for.
What if I told you that you could get this book for free?
I would say that you're a liar and beat you to death in the street and take your money.
What would a Ferengi say about that? I don't know, but it's true. You can get this book for free.
They would say that that's up, terrible.
If you sign up for audible.com.
The Ferengi do not approve of this transaction.
Audible is a great way for you to read all of the books you've always wanted to read but never thought you'd have time for. Audible is the premier source for audiobooks with more than 150,000 titles to choose from and new titles coming every week. From classics to current bestsellers, Audible has something for everyone. As a Trek.fm listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. So give it a try today. catch up on all those classic books you've yet to read or that latest novel from your favorite author as well, just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm, and we thank you and Audible for supporting Commentary, Trek Stars, and Trek.fm. As always, you can find us on Trek.fm doing this show. You can also find me on Trek.fm doing Standard Orbit, and you can find both of us on CommentaryTrackStars.com, where we do Commentary Track Stars off topic with our friend Brandon. If you want to leave us some feedback, send us an email at comtrackstars@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter at comtrackstars. All right, so there's Robert Hewitt Wolf's career in Star Trek. I'm really looking forward to seeing what he has up his sleeve for the rest of his career as an unsung hero. And we will be starting that up next week with a television movie that he did right after Deep Space Nine called Futuresport.